In late 2000, the Baltimore Sun published an article about a student named Wes Moore who'd become the first Black Rhodes Scholar from Johns Hopkins University. Around the same time, the Sun ran a story about another Wes Moore, just 2 years older, who'd grown up in the same neighborhood and been involved in the murder of a police officer. The first Wes Moore has written about how their similar upbringings led to completely divergent lives in a book called The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much.
What was your first reaction when you read the story of The Other Wes Moore in the newspaper?
It was jarring. Yeah, I remember the first time I actually heard his name was I was in South Africa on a study abroad as a student at Johns Hopkins, and my mother called me, and she said, "I've got something crazy to tell you." She said, "There are wanted posters all over your neighborhood for Wes Moore, for the murder of a police officer. And if you see him, do not approach because he's assumed to be armed and very dangerous." And it just shocked me hearing this news. And then as I read more articles and learned more about it, there's really almost this fascination to learn more really began.
Well, how closely did you live?
We were, by the time of his arrest, we were blocks away.
So, and yet you'd never heard of him? I would have thought somebody would have come up to you and said,
"Yeah,
you know, there's another guy with the same name."
And I'd never heard of him. I'd never known him before learning about him because of the tragic murder of the police officer.
You've had a number of careers since your time as a Rhodes Scholar. You're a paratrooper and captain in the Army in Afghanistan, a White House fellow as a special assistant to Condoleezza Rice, an investment professional in New York. Did you lose track of the other Wes Moore during all of those years?
No. In fact, as I began my career, the idea of him continued to haunt me. The idea that now here was a person that not only shared my name, but also we both had grown up in single-parent households, that we both were living in the same neighborhoods. We both had trouble academically and in terms of discipline issues in our neighborhoods. And so this concept really haunted me. So that's really what made me want to reach out to him in the first place.
And there were any number of novels in the early 19th century of the doppelganger, the two people who are two versions of the same thing. Did you see yourself as being another version of this guy?
Well, what I saw was I'd done over, you know, after I got a chance to reach out to Wes and he ended up writing me back. And so for...
Well, you wrote to him first?
I wrote to him first.
How did you know where he was?
I actually contacted Jessup Correctional Institution. And I said, I'd like to get in touch with a prisoner there. How do I do it? They explained to me how the process works, and I wrote Wes a note and just basically saying, introducing myself and asking him a whole list of, in retrospect, pretty naive questions. And then a month later, I got a note back from Jessup Correctional Institution from Wes Moore. And that was really how it began. That one letter turned into dozens of letters, and those dozens of letters turned into dozens of visits.
Well, he had changed a lot over the years.
He has changed a lot. I think, you know, Wes has now been in prison for 10 years and he'll spend the rest of his life there. But I think he has grown in some ways because of this process, as have I.
But do you think that if you had written to him, let's say, the first or second year after he'd gone to jail, that he would have responded in the same way?
It's a great question. I don't know. I know that one of the first things that Wes wrote back to me in that first letter that I received from him was he thanked me for writing him. And he thanked me for writing him because he said, when you're in prison, you think that no one in the world even knows you exist anymore. And then he proceeded to answer the questions that I had. So I know throughout this process, you know, Wes feels that burden, that aloneness every day.
Well, also, he must have been as surprised by the fact that your name is Wes Moore as he was. And then
Absolutely.
When you told him about all the other similarities, his dad had left when he was very young. Your father died when you were very young.
Yes. Yeah, my father died when I was 3 years old. In fact, I watched him die. He had something called acute epiglottitis, which is basically a swelling of the epiglottis, and it covered his windpipe to the point that his body essentially suffocated itself. But Wes has only met his father three times in his life. In fact, one of the anecdotes I have in the book was a conversation that Wes and I were having where we were talking about the absence of our fathers. And Wes said, you know, your father wasn't there because he couldn't be. And my father wasn't there because he chose not to be. And therefore, we're going to mourn their absence differently.
Does he see that as a major cause of the way his life went?
I think he does. I think one thing that, you know, happened with both of us, and I think for a lot of people, particularly a lot of boys who are growing up, you know, without the father in the home, is there's that void that you spend a lot of time trying to fill with something, with someone. And if you don't have those positive influences to help fill that void, you generally tend to look at other areas to do it. And I think you saw a lot of that with Wes.
Well, some people might say, well, okay, the both of you grew up in with your mothers raising you. Yeah. His mother didn't do as good a job as your mother did.
Well, and I think it's not that simple. It's not that simple to say, you know, that it's an easy equation like that. I have an extraordinary mother. And I've been absolutely blessed that that I can have her as a mother. But I also know she had a lot of leverage. You know, I have my grandparents who, you know, were living up in the Bronx who, after my father died, and she was having a lot of difficulties with that, we moved up to the Bronx to live with my grandparents, which I think was very helpful. I think we had a lot of other community supports that were there in place. And I think I always understood that even when I was going through my personal challenges up here in New York, that love and that stalwart support was there. And I think that's something that was really lacking in many cases from Wes.
He didn't have that extended family.
He didn't have the extended family. His main role model was his older brother. And his older brother, is, you know, as I, you know, kind of give, you know, details inside of the book, was not a role model for anybody. I mean, Tony was, you know, dropped out of school in eighth grade, was involved in the drug game before he was even 10. You know, this was a person who was heavily troubled himself and really had no reason teaching anybody else anything.
But you said you weren't a particularly well-behaved teenager.
Yeah.
You were suspended from school at one point.
Yeah, well, a few times. So I was on academic and disciplinary probation. While I was up in school in the Bronx eventually, and was sent to a military school when I was just turned 12 years old. And so I had a mandatory year in military school, which I think was something that really helped change my life around.
My guest is Wes Moore. His book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, is published by Spiegel and Grau. Well, why do you think you were acting out? Was it also because you didn't have your father there, or was it the area you were growing up in?
I think it was part of the fact that I felt a tremendous amount of anger about my father not being there. I felt a lot of uncertainty. And I think also my mother was, you know, trying to be creative about different things that she could do to help me. And she ended up sending me to a private school out in the Bronx, which was a great school. And in retrospect, it was a blown opportunity for me. But I think what it did was it really put me in this place of confusion where I was, you know, increasingly becoming too rich for the kids in the neighborhood because I went across town to school, too poor for the kids at school, and so I almost was on this island by myself in the middle.
On the other hand, it would suggest that you came from a more middle-class family than the other Wes Moore, and that did offer you all sorts of opportunities that were denied him.
To an extent. I mean, I tell you the truth, in terms of the socioeconomic background of both boys, they're actually, you know, really quite similar. You know, my mother worked three different jobs at that time to try to, you know, provide for, you know, have that as a real opportunity. But when you look at the areas that we were growing up in the Bronx during the, you know, mid-late 1980s and the areas of West Baltimore and Baltimore County that Wes grew up in, they are frighteningly similar.
Now, I grew up in some pretty rough areas and was a poor student and played hooky an awful lot. But one of the things I never could have imagined doing was committing a crime, other than playing hooky. This may have been one of the biggest differences between the two of you. I'm sure you never imagined doing anything really seriously illegal.
Yeah.
What happened with Wes?
I think part of it is it's the areas that you're in, the people that you're around, and what is deemed to be acceptable. I think, you know, I actually, you know, had gotten involved, you know, when I was 11 years old. I, you know, ended up with, you know, in the back of a police car with handcuffs on. So I think, but again, a lot of it was because of, that's what a lot of my friends were doing. And so that was the road that I ended up going down. And it's amazing when you're talking about whether it be Wes or just, you know, kids as a whole, how these small things can really compound and become much bigger things and how slippery that slope can be.
But you were in the Bronx or you were going to private schools. Did he graduate from high school?
He did not. He left high school in 10th grade and never went back.
And hung out with a dangerous group of friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you describe the robbery and murder that led to his imprisonment?
Yeah, so that day there were four guys ran into a jewelry store. Two of them had guns and two of them had mallets. And the two guys with guns got everybody on the ground. And the two with mallets proceeded to go around the jewelry store and smash jewelry cases. And they got away with about $400,000 worth of jewelry and then ran out of the store. The one of the people that was on the ground was an off-duty police officer, an off-duty police sergeant named Bruce Prothero, who, you know, from every indication, every shred of evidence I got, was an absolute hero, a man of integrity and character. And he got up and ran out of the store to try to stop them from getting away. And he was hiding next to cars to try to figure out where they were, and didn't realize that one of the cars that he was kneeling next to was one of the vehicles they were in. And they opened the window and shot him three times, two times in the chest, one time in the head, and killed him instantly.
When you say they, was Wes one of the people with the gun?
Wes was convicted. It was Wes, his older brother, and two other people were all convicted of felony murder for the crime.
Does he express any remorse for it now?
Wes, you know, still to this day tries to say that he wasn't there that day, which there's a scene in the book where I talk about it, how he was explaining this to me. And it confounded me then, and it still confounds me to this day. He you know, says he's sorry for the police officer's family and for their loss. But again, to this day, I don't understand the
He says he was somewhere else?
He says he was somewhere else, and I don't understand the claim. I really don't.
You've been to visit him on numerous occasions.
Yeah.
Is he in the same prison?
He is. He's a Jessup Correctional Institution, and he's been there for 10 years now.
What is that prison like?
It's, any maximum security facility that you go to is just jarring. As soon as you walk in, the sounds of the gates closing behind you, the sounds of the police officers' rubber soles squeaking against the ground. I mean, everything is magnified, and as soon as you walk in, there's no way of not realizing where you are, and this element of control that you've just walked into.
And you're totally trapped.
And you're completely trapped. You're not allowed to have anything, bring anything in with you. I literally did my interviews with Wes, having to sit across from them and just ask him questions, he'd answer them, and then I have to run back to my car after our session was done and then talk into a tape recorder that I had waiting for me in the car and then just regurgitate everything that he said.
Did you ever feel trapped when you were working for Condoleezza Rice and people were so critical of the policies of the Bush administration?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I'd spent the year before being a White House fellow on the ground.
How did you even come to
work for
them? Be a White House fellow?
My deputy brigade commander was a former White House fellow. And when I was in Afghanistan, I was with the 82nd Airborne Division. So I was a paratrooper over there. And he said, you should really consider this White House fellowship. And he said, and you should consider it next year because it's important for you to come back and then be able to see how Washington works after this experience.
Did you have any aspirations to get into politics at this point?
No. I had aspirations to be a public servant. But I wasn't sure exactly how it would manifest itself. And I knew that this would be an interesting way of doing it. So I put together my application and I received the fellowship, which was outstanding because you spend a year on the ground in Afghanistan. And then you come back and then seeing how these policies are actually enacted. And then you come back and spend a year seeing how these policies are actually produced. And you see the differences between them, and you try to build that bridge. So it was a fascinating experience.
Well, when you're in the military in a place like Afghanistan and things are falling apart, and things were falling apart, and that was one of the things that became a major campaign issue in the presidential election, you probably think, gee, if I could only go there and tell these people what they're doing wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you did try at times. Did anybody listen, or did they say, Wes, you don't understand politics?
Well, I think they do listen, but I think what was important to stress, and I think you see it not only with what was happening in Afghanistan, but even what was happening, even going back to the book, is the disconnect sometimes between the policies that are being made and the people that the policies are intended to affect. And that's what I tried to do, was help people to understand that this disconnect does exist. And I think, we see it in, even some of the things that I wrote about. You see it where there were certain policies that were enacted that were supposed to help certain situations, intended to help certain communities. But if you really get down to the people they were supposed to affect, almost had a counterproductive effect on it.
We're still seeing major problems in Afghanistan. Do you think that that situation can ever work itself out?
I think what we needed to do in Afghanistan, and what I saw when I was over there, was we were underfunded and under-resourced and undermanned my entire time over there. I think that since we now are putting more of a focus on it, both in terms of military capacity, but also more importantly, civilian capacity, development capacity, reconstruction capacity, is I think we can actually start seeing real results, and I think we have already started seeing real results in that angle.
Your book is essentially about the consequences of personal responsibility. And I remember when I was in high school and people would come and give us speeches. And some of us went on to live productive lives and other ones went out going and screwing up. Some are a lot of people I went to school with are in jail right now. So what does that mean? If somebody reads this book, do you think that they may very well suddenly change the course of their life?
I think that what this book does, this book is it shows that this is much bigger than just these two boys. And it's much bigger than one socioeconomic group. It's much bigger than one racial demographic. This is about all of our decisions and about how all of our decisions, how sometimes the smallest decisions that we make can have such big consequences. And it's about who we are as a society. It's about the type of things that we put focus on, the type of things that we put emphasis on, and what are our expectations for these type of communities. And one of the things I wanted to highlight and show in this book is you fundamentally have two kids here. Both kids were having difficulties coming up. Both kids were searching for help and searching for more. One of the kids got the help. The other kid didn't. And now the world can bear witness to the final results. So that's one of the things I think this book really helps to emphasize is the interconnectedness of all of us. And these are urgent issues that we deal with in this. And they're much bigger than just these two kids.
You talked about being interested in doing public service. Well, you're working in the financial sector these days, probably the most maligned area in our country. Do you have any thoughts of going into politics or going into education?
Well, I mean, issues of education and issues of public service are things I'm involved in right now. I really wanted to go and learn what was happening in finance because I understood how integral understanding that was, even in terms of the policy conversations. How many things that, when I was down in Washington was actually where I first got an understanding that I wanted to, learn how finance works because I realized that all Washington is, it's governing and it's decision-making and that's budgets. And understanding how that world works, I thought was very important in terms of understanding how the larger, political cycle works. But for the things that I'm really looking at, the things I really want to focus on, is my belief that public service doesn't have to be an occupation, but public service needs to be a way of life.
Although he worked for Condoleezza Rice, Westmore was a featured speaker at the 2008 Democratic National Convention. He was named one of Ebony Magazine's top 30 leaders under 30, and most recently dubbed one of the top young business leaders in New York by Crain's New York Business. His book, The Other Westmore, One Name, Two Fates, published by Spiegel & Grau. He will be reading and signing books tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at 82nd Street and Broadway. Thank you so much for being with us.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much.